When it comes to showing appreciation, the gift you choose says everything. Minky Couture luxury blankets make the perfect statement. Soft, stylish, and unforgettable. Whether you're thanking a client, rewarding an employee, or celebrating a milestone, nothing delivers warmth and gratitude like a Minky blanket. With custom options and elegant packaging, your gift will stand out and be remembered long after the moment has passed. Make your corporate gifting extraordinary with Minky Couture. Luxury you can feel. Visit minkycouture.com to get started.
Giles Brown.
Let's talk.
Brilliant sounding rubbish is a sharp thought. That's not me, by the way. Is a sharp, thoughtful, and ultimately hopeful look at the past, present, and future of the music industry from one of the people who helped shape it. Delighted to say that I'm joined live on the line, probably from, I don't know, a swimming pool, you know, on the side of on a sun lounger somewhere in LA or something. Ladies and gentlemen, it's only Kev Nixon. Kev, good morning to you.
Good morning. Nice to see you.
Where do we find you this morning, by the way? So whereabouts are you?
So we're in the South Downs in Sussex, which is about 50 miles south of London. We used to live in Brighton because we started music colleges there, but we bought a place just in the hills so we could get away from everybody.
Yeah, was it Brighton, or was it Hove, actually?
Yeah, we were in Hove, actually. We were. But no, it's great out here. And, you know, we're very isolated. So we feel like we're in the land that time forgot, which is a good thing.
And you see, the listeners can't see this, but I can see you. And whenever I do Zooms, occasionally we have people put backgrounds in the back, you know, in the background, obviously. And I just said, I'm getting microphone envy, but I've just looked behind you and I'm also getting bass and acoustic envy as well, because you've got two beauties sitting there behind you.
Right. Yeah, well, you know, I was born into a family of musicians, so I've been playing since I was five. And they're all jazz musicians. And everybody reached a very high standard, but none of us read music. So we were, you know, old school ear trained musicians, but we all ended up with making a living out of music.
And you said that you were so musical that even the sewing machine was musical.
Even the sewing machine was a singer. That's the family joke.
So where did your musical journey take you? Because you went to the States, you went to the mother load, didn't you? You went to the mother node of it all.
Well, I started touring as soon as I left school, so I was 16, and then I got a record deal when I was 17, and as soon as you get a deal, then the world opens up. So I was touring the UK and Europe to start with, had a few hits in Europe, and then, you know, as things progressed, I got in my early 20s, I started recording. I became a producer when I was 21, and I started recording in places like New York, and, you know, and it just exploded from there, really. I've had the most amazing life and the most amazing career. And the reason why I wrote this book is so that young people today can have that kind of excitement and that kind of opportunity, because it's diminishing.
When you're producing, say in the late 60s, going to the early 70s, this is all analog, isn't it? Because today you know I could pick up my iPhone and twiddle a few knobs, shows what I know, but you know, push a few buttons and you know, drop a buck in a brick in a bucket and make a top 20 hit sort of thing. But we're talking reel to reel, aren't we? We're talking sort of 8-track, 24. I mean, what, it must have been, you must have been really pushing the edge then and pushing the envelope, as it was, Kevin.
Yeah, we were. I mean, what you're talking about, what you could do today, that's brilliant sounding rubbish, because it sounds great, but it's not necessarily great music. That's why the book's called that.
Yeah.
But in my day, and you know, up until fairly recently, since digital music, you learned the skills of music before you recorded. And this is an absolutely crucial thing, because today you can have a hit record without having any musical ability at all.
But here's the thing, Kev, because I speak to a lot of people about this, because when, you know, I'm coming up to my 60s, but when I was 70, it's a rite of passage. If you're a guy or a girl, to have a garage band, you all film a garage band. You know, we wanted to be Blondie, or we wanted to be the Lex Lidd, Skinhead, or the Doors, or something. And we get together and we thrash out tracks, and it would be bleeding awful. But we kind of learnt the basics of playing together. Yes. And today, although it's great that people, young people, can create music in their bedrooms, and there's always been a history that's going back 25 years or so now with computers or whatever, they're missing out on that live experience and also, you know, going out and doing the rounds and playing live gigs and getting told, you know, playing to literally three people in the room, because now it's because they don't have the incentive to get out there.
Yeah, well, that's your apprenticeship, and today you bypass that because that word garage band is actually, it's a major problem in the music industry, because the garage band app is on every Apple device. And last year that was 307 million devices that have all got a mini recording studio. And so everybody's an artist, everybody's a producer, and it's full of loops that make the drums sound great without playing the drums, etc. And, you know, on one level, it's great fun to do that if you can play as well, because it gives you a wider aspect. But if you can't play, you're going to get found out at some point, because, you know, when you want to go and take a great sounding record on stage, you suddenly have to hire musicians. And hiring musicians is very different to collaborating with musicians in bands. What you get from collaboration is you get that human energy where there's a bit of competition, a bit like John Lennon and Paul McCartney. Oh, Paul's written a really good one, I'm going to write a better one. And that pushing of the envelope and raising of the standards, that is missing in today's music, because we're in a world full of bedroom solo artists where no one's got 45 minutes to listen to your stuff. It's all 3 minutes and it's all got to be great.
The other thing is the fact that because of what streaming services have done to songwriting, because with a streaming service, if people don't pick up on in the first 20 seconds, they'll shuffle onto something else. You know, and I know I'm going to sound like a crusty, you know, grumpy old so-and-so, because I am in the mornings, but there was, you'd go to the record shop, kids ask your parents, or get a cassette, and you'd pop it in, or you'd unwrap the vinyl, you'd put it on, and there was that expectation of listening, and you'd do the whole album. And when you get, and I'm going to use a word the listeners know because I'm not a huge fan, an Ed Sheeran or a Taylor Swift, and they come on and all their songs are number one, it's not got the same voyage of discovery, if you know what I mean, Kev.
Well, I think you've picked two artists there who are actually really gifted songwriters. But generally speaking, we're in an era where gifted songwriters can't get through the traffic because there's so much old music around. And, you know, we all love old music. It's human nature to love music that you grew up with. But today, we the music business, we're selling music from 50 years ago or 30 years ago in the case of Oasis. And it is completely log-jammed up the opportunities for young musicians today. And if you look at Britain, if you go on Instagram, you look at the British artists who are posting, there is phenomenal talent out there. So the talent level is not the issue. The problem is that it's a system that does not allow for opportunity to grow naturally. And this is where the difference is between old music and new music. New music is instant. Old music grew. But on the intro thing that you just mentioned, the 20 seconds, that's nothing to do with digital music. That was going on in day one. If you think about She Loves You, the first 20 seconds of She Loves You has got you. That's, if you want to get on the radio, you've got to have that first 20 seconds, no matter what. You know, the fact that it's now streaming, that hasn't really affected it. If you want to hit record, you got to start with the chorus. And most people have an intro, then a first verse, and then a chorus. So it's a bit of a myth that streaming has changed that kind of thinking.
Okay, Kev, whatever happens in the middle eight then? Because if I hear a middle eight now, I go, oh, fantastic, or take it to the bridge. Because it seems, and again, because I have goddaughters who listen to the current music, and I'm thinking, well, where's the break? Where's the middle eighth? Where's the thing? Because it just seems to be chorus. I mean, I know that it was always chorus, whatever, you know, two choruses and three verses. But was this what you were trying? What you're trying to teach your students, as it were?
Well, middle eighths started in the jazz world, in the blues and jazz world. So again, there's nothing new about them. But actually, you know, some of the biggest hits ever have got no middle eights. Tomorrow Never Knows would be a Beatles track that I would just pluck out of the air and say, and for me, it's one of the best songs they ever did. But, you know, it's having this formulaic attitude that is the problem, because when you're in a band and there's two or three writers and the competition's there, as I was describing, you know, sometimes you could start with a middle eight. Someone might suggest having a three-minute outro like Hey Jude. I'm using the Beatles as a reference because
everybody they're international. Knows. Absolutely, yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So those ideas, they get sparked by working with like-minded people who actually are all working collectively to improve the music you're working on. And when you're an individual and, you know, you might think, okay, well, that's gone on for 2 minutes. Do I put a middle eight in? You can try it. But the fact is that it's got to be of a high standard to bring together the other areas of the song. Otherwise, why have it, you know?
The great thing about the period that you start off with, it was nobody had ever done rock and roll before. That whole period, that 50s, 60s, 70s. And so you get this wonderful progression, and it's the artists and the technology. You're breaking, you know, you're pushing the envelope, as it was. And you know, you're kind of making it up as you go along. And that's the way we kind of end up with prog rock, you know. Yes, and, you know, great album covers and, you know, three vinyls in a thing. And then we get the reaction of punk and new wave and things like that. And because nobody knew what was coming next. And the industry wasn't so much an industry then. Whereas now, of course, the music business is a huge industry and it is very conservative. So they won't push for new stuff coming up. They will want you, if you are a grime artist, you have to sing in this way. If you are a female artist, you sing in this way. I mean, hopefully we've got over the boy band era or whatever, but you see what I'm saying here. There are even the small independent labels tend to be run by a bigger label, as it were. So they're not pushing the envelope. They're not throwing stuff out there to see if it sticks in the way that it was perhaps in the 70s and the 60s.
What you're talking about is counterculture.
Yeah.
So in the 50s, it was Teddy Boys following Elvis. 60s, it was mods and rockers and then hippies following everybody who played at Monterey Pop Festival. Then in the 70s, it was glam rock and punk. 80s, it was new romantics. 90s, it was Britpop. And then it stopped. This is the problem. Countercultures delivered incredible music, because there was nobody around getting in their way. This music came from the streets. Today, everything's formulaic. Everything comes out of computers. And when we had our music colleges, you know, one of the reasons why we were so successful was that we wouldn't let students start recording until they'd got the skills to be able to play and to write properly. Because if you just go headlong in and start recording, you're going to have brilliant sounding, you're going to have demos that actually no one's going to pick up on. And so that period of learning, it doesn't matter what area you're in, you need to do that in collaboration with other people who have got great ideas. And one of the great things about BIM and Dime, the music colleges we opened in the UK and in America, was that we just brought kids together, really. They took care of the rest of it because they found each other inspiring. There's always somebody coming in the door who you were like, shit, what an amazing singer. Let's get them on the track. And so off it goes. Then we can let go. The fact that you have to pass a degree, you know, really, we were doing music degrees, but you don't need a degree to make it in the music business. What you need is ability and you need to be smart. And those rules have always applied. So right back through those countercultures, those were the essence of why we had so much originality and why British music dominated the world. Today, unfortunately, mobile phones, music on mobile phones has made it an individual experience. So you put headphones on, you listen to it while you're commuting. That's an individual experience where no one can share the pleasures that you are having. That's the reason why there's no counterculture today, because music is digital.
The other thing I always say to when I speak to, you know, having played awful music myself live, connection is vital in music. The connection between musicians, between each other, and also with a live audience. Because if you're playing with a live audience and they come back to you and they're loving what you do, there is no better drug on the planet than playing to a live audience.
Well, that's still the case. I mean, the problem is that the live audiences are all in their 60s and the bands are all in their 40s. So, you know, I was doing a chat with another person the other day, and they said, how come there's no bands anymore? There are tons of bands. The problem is they're all old. That is the problem. And so because people can't get involved in a lot of new music and a lot of digital music, they're bound to go and want to see these old bands, which has created a massive live economy. So my father-in-law, he's a promoter, Live Nation, he's a legend. He started with Little Richard.
Just a small company, Live Nation. Blimey.
But Barry, his name's Barry Clayman, and, you know, he was responsible for touring artists like Barbra Streisand, Prince, Michael Jackson. I mean, as big as you can get. And it's never dropped. The live industry was massive back then, and it's massive today. So that is the most healthy area of the music business, and the reason is because mobile phones are not involved.
But the flip side of that is the fact that though we may get these big acts going out, the Oasis filling out stadium, etc., stadia, it's the smaller live music venues that are in problems at the moment. It's the pubs, it's the clubs, it's those venues that we really need to protect, because that's the testing ground for any young band. And they're shutting at an alarming rate as kids decide to stay in and look at their phones all the time.
You know, I think there's a bit of overreaction to that, personally. Okay. Not to be argumentative.
But no, please. You're the expert here, man. No problem at all.
I'll give you an example. When we came to Brighton in 2001 and we owned BIM, there was no pubs and there was no grassroots venues. The place was like a ghost town. So we opened our music college. We had 300 kids in the first year. Every pub was opening its back room and putting a PA system and a stage in there. And I'm not exaggerating, but within 6 months, Brighton was alive with new music. So, you know, the grass venues thing is there because there's no young artists who are going out and learning the hard way like Ed Sheeran did. You know, a friend of mine actually discovered Ed and produced his first three albums. And the truth of it is that Ed was touring from 16 years old and he never stopped. He did something like 500 open mic nights before he even thought of ringing a record company. That is what you need to do. Get up there and play. And there are places. It's a myth to worry about grassroots killing off music. It's individualism that's killing it off.
My eldest goddaughter has a band in Brighton called Ziggy Phoenix, and they are playing all the time in Brighton itself. It's funny you mention that. So therefore, it just goes to prove me wrong. When kids were coming to universities, what were their aims? I mean, presumably they want to be musicians. They don't want to be stars. Because if you want to be a star, you go into like an X Factor or Britain's Got Talent or something like that.
I hope not. A lot of them did want to be stars. And in fact, in the first year, the Kooks came out of our college. And then later we had people like Tom O'Dell, George Ezra. We had something like 7 in 10 years who got not only got major deals, they sold over 1 million of their debut album. James Bay, for example, who we all helped a great deal. And, you know, the difference between our college and any other college is that me and Sarah, my wife, we've been in the music business all our lives. And so we were part of the music business. 99% of all music education is taught in educational environments. Our colleges look like rock and roll shops. You know, we modelled them on the art schools of the 60s, which actually I went to one of those in the 70s. And if you look at the list of famous artists who went to art school, from John Lennon to Pete Townsend, I mean, the list is unbelievable, and it's still going on. What you actually got there was you got a clash of cultures. And so one example would be, from a lyrical point of view, everybody who was at those art schools was a book reader, was an intelligent person. And so the commentary that came from lyrics in the 60s and 70s while this was going on, David Bowie, another example, in an art school.
Yeah.
These guys, they were meeting painters, they were meeting sculptors. And so we're talking about high culture here.
It's also being, you mentioned sort of Bowie and that, they're looking outside. If you think about the Beatles again, you look at the wonderful stages the Beatles go through, and that's because they were always curious about the world. So that's why,
Yeah, they were. And, you know, in John Lennon, they had a guy who was an incredible poet and who also ran a student magazine when he was at art school, which became the Merseybeat, you know, the magazine that, you know, there's 300 bands around on Merseyside. And so they formed a newspaper called Merseybeat. Lennon was a contributor to it. This is the kind of culture that I'm talking about. There's no reason why that couldn't be happening in Brighton, in Marbella, in Bristol. It doesn't matter. If you want to love what you do, you've got to be with people who are like-minded and also love what they do.
So there's the book isn't it was better in my day sort of autobiography, is it? There is hope, and there you have a plan, and you have a vision for the future of young people. Because music is exciting, music is fun, music is great. So yes. What are you aiming to do with the book, Kev?
So the book does is exposes the truth about what happens in the music business. It's not really an autobiography, although it is my journey through 50 years in the music business.
Yeah.
What the music business is very good at, because it's dominated by three major labels, so they've got a total monopoly on the whole industry, including buying up all the independents right now, which is killing the subcultures. But in essence, this is a warning. This is what they're sweeping under the carpet. If you read this book, you will find out all the gory details of what actually goes on. And it's not like I'm a whistleblower. It's just that kids need to know this before they spend 40 grand on a music degree and think they're going to have a career in this industry. You know, this year alone, there's been something like 400 people let go from the major labels just in London. The industry's shrinking because, you know, as is the world, because robotics are taking over, AI is taking over, and no one is stopping it. No one is taking the responsibility to say, we need a reboot of the music business so that the music comes first. So there's loads of ideas towards the end of the book on what we can do to change it for the better. For instance, I'll give you one quick instance. If you want to be chart eligible with your label, I've suggested we have legislation that there has to be a director of music on the board of every record label, somebody qualified who understands music, who can make a reasonable judgment on the quality of the music that is going out there. Because nobody in the music business ever thinks about customer satisfaction. It's a long gone word.
Fascinating. I could talk to you literally till probably about this time next week, but
I'll
come to Marbella. Come to Marbella. I'll get you in the studio. I'll clear all the decks and we can put the world to rights. Listeners, if you want to get the book, go to our website. Great front cover, by the way, Black Sheep.
I'm so proud of it.
Yeah, absolutely loved it. Listeners, you can go onto our website, go to our virtual bookstore, click on Brilliant Sounding Rubbish, and a well-known distribution service will be winging its way to you before you can say, flip over to the B side. Kev, if people want to find you online, where's the best place to engage with you? Because I know you've got a website, because as you probably gathered, I was reading it. So where can they find you?
Yeah, kevnixon.com.
The book is called Brilliant Sounding Rubbish. It's by Kev Nixon. Kev, it's been an absolute honour to speak to you this morning.
Well, for me too, Jazz. You've got such enthusiasm. I really love talking to people who have got that energy. So we're mates now, and I will come to Marbella, I promise.
Well, I look forward to that one. Kev Nixon, thank you so much for your time today.
Okay, thank you very much.
When it comes to showing appreciation, the gift you choose says everything. Minky Couture luxury blankets make the perfect statement. Soft, stylish, and unforgettable. Whether you're thanking a client, rewarding an employee, or celebrating a milestone, nothing delivers warmth and gratitude like a Minky blanket. With custom options and elegant packaging, your gift will stand out and be remembered long after the moment has passed. Make your corporate gifting extraordinary with Minky Couture, luxury you can feel. Visit minkycouture.com to get started.